Hello, and welcome back to another episode of DD Geopolitics podcast live stream. I am your host, and your other host is finally back from safari.
Woo!
Chris, welcome back. Are you happy to be back in Moscow?
I'm so happy to be back. It's a pleasure to be with you and everybody here tonight. Let's get it going.
You're very excited to be back. We're going to cover Chris's trip in the end, so you guys can leave on a high note. Usually we leave you with a black bill. Again, I am once again begging you to read a piece to end all peace, as we, especially as we segue into our first segment. And also before that, I am reading this book right now, The Fort Bragg Cartel, and I am terrified. Especially since these are the people that are in Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Highly recommend this book. I'm also pressuring Chris to get the author to come and speak to us. So hopefully Seth will come. And then lastly, last night we did a different type of space where we actually read a book. I don't think that people that spend a lot of time on Twitter read a lot. So I decided to do a public service. And we read Zionist Relations with Nazi Germany, which is by Faris Yahya, and it's part of the Palestinian Liberation Series. I highly recommend it. And then we did a 4-hour space, and that's still on my personal profile. You guys would like to listen to it. So I don't let my viewers be stupid. Everybody needs to go forth and read. And we're also trying to twist Chris's arm to start a DDG book club, restart the DDG book club. I'm trying to voluntel some of our followers to do it. We'll see if that can come to fruition. Any publishers that want to do a partnership, hit us up.
We're ready.
Okay. Now to get to the meat and potatoes today, obviously we're going to cover Chris's trip at the end. We have a special guest. It's our good friend and one of our oldest friends, Scott from Calibrated, will come on to do our Russia-Ukraine update. But first, obviously, we're going to talk about the breaking news, which is the ceasefire that we knew would not last, has not lasted. In all reality, it was broken before it really even began. But today, I think it becomes official. Earlier this week, Trump had something to say about the gangs in Gaza.
Mr. President, previously you did not seem to be bothered regarding Hamas cracking down on...
Sorry, wrong video. Disarming Hamas. Okay, so earlier this week, Trump threatened Hamas to disarm them, that we would go in. Again, he said it again in an interview today. So here is that clip.
Warrior.
And yet, as soon as you left, Hamas executed 7 people, and then they went on to execute 30 more.
Yeah.
Do you believe they really will disarm?
Well, they promised they would. They said they would. It's down that they would. Now, they said they were gang members, et cetera, you know. But these are very violent people. This is a very violent part of the world. Nobody's seen violence like this. If we have to, we'll disarm
the U.S.
Well, whether it's me or the U.S. or it's, you know, a proxy, could be Israel with our backing. We won't have boots on the ground. There's no reason to.
Is there a timeline to get Hamas to disarm in your mind?
Not a timeline, not a hard line, but we're going to see how it all works out. They've lived there for a long time. They're very violent. As you understand, you've been covering it for a long time, but we're going to find out. Don't forget, 50,000 of them have been killed, okay? Mm-hmm. So they killed 1,200 people in horrible, the October 7th attack. It was an attack. They killed 1,200. But
it's becoming clearer and clearer that there's really no plan for the implementation of Trump's peace plan. Mm-hmm. And Trump said I like that he called Israel a proxy there. I don't know that Netanyahu is going to enjoy that. But we're also leading up to building this narrative of what has happened over the past week. And today, October 19th, is the first day of the olive harvest. Now, an American journalist by the name of Jasper Nathaniel is there, and he, please visit his page. He did an 8-minute mini documentary on it. But here's what's going on.
You got it. Oh, come on. Don't fucking hit her. Hey.
Oh, my God.
Hey. Hey. Hey.
Holy shit.
Hey.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Hey, get in, get in, get in!
So that's him in the vehicle in the black as the Israeli settlers come in. And this has been going on all week. Obviously, they're tending to their what's left of their olive groves and orchards. And so this is the first day of this year's harvest. It's just bleak. Like, I don't.
It's hard to watch. It really is hard to watch. And I've been in Palestine. I've been to the occupied West Bank, and to see the not only, you know, settler atrocities and attacks and the violence, but also cutting down and burning of these olive trees that are centuries, if not millennia old, is very hard to see.
And here's Jasper again. If I am killed in the West Bank, please know that I blame you personally, Governor Mike Huckabee, who obviously is the U.S. ambassador to Israel and a just absolute cuck for the Zionists. I was set up by the IDF to be attacked by 100 armed settlers. When I sent the embassy the video and asked for protection for me and everyone else in Tormuzaya, they literally said no.
Yep. Yeah, of course they empower these settlers. They empower these settlers. This is the fanatical army that isn't actually part of the army, but is an army and an extension of the greater Zionist project, the greater Israel project. This is exactly what this is their purpose. Their purpose is to do things that the government can't do because of sanctions, because of international pressure, because of the boycotts, divestment sanctions, because of how it would look image-wise. They send these fanatical freaks out there to go and do this violence. And then they say, we can't do anything. Oh, we got to check in the courts. And they let them go. They let them go.
Well, and it's also important to note that America pays for their livelihood.
Their healthcare. Their education, their security. Some of these people just sit around all day beating people, and then they go home and they read the Torah and the Talmud. Why should I pay for that? You want to read that stuff? Good, on your dime, not mine. Right?
I want to put this tweet up again in case you guys want to go to his page and watch that mini documentary. It is about 8 minutes long. Infinite_jazz. I highly, highly recommend and keep an eye on that situation. What we do know is that as 41 minutes after the ceasefire began, Israel was hitting Gaza with artillery shells. But I guess like those didn't count. I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. There was also a drone strike on a vehicle, which I guess also doesn't count. There was also dozens of headlines of Israeli airstrikes. This is like from last week. Here's the 16th. Some of them are from the 9th. So that, like, it's just been happening this entire time. But I guess today, because of the severity of it, is when we actually start reporting on it. So here is Donald Trump now talking about the gangs of Gaza.
Mr. President, previously you did not seem to be bothered regarding Hamas cracking down on what you called gangs,
actually, what?
A couple of gangs. And today you issued a threat against Hamas on Truth Social. What has changed?
And what was said? Go ahead.
You said that they keep killing innocents in Gaza. If that continues, the United States...
Yeah, I know. I issued a strong statement. That's right.
But they used to be gangs, and now you're saying innocence. What made you think they're innocents now?
Well, I'm looking at what's happening, and that wasn't the deal that was made, and we'll see what happens. It's calmed down. It's a tough neighborhood. We know that.
We have a commitment from them, and I assume they're going to honor that commitment. I hope they do. And I understand they brought back some additional bodies today. It's a rough deal when you think of it, right? Very rough. And we have our hostages back completely. We were very lucky with that. It's a tough situation. They brought back bodies today, as you probably know. But they also said they're going to behave. We're going to find out if they behave. If they behave, good. If they don't behave, we'll take care of it.
He never even answers the question.
No.
We know that there are gangs in Gaza. We wrote about it in July. Highly recommend the article. It's free. What keeps happening? I don't know. But either way, it's called Guns, Flour, and Blood, How Israel Uses Aid and Militias to Legitimize Mass Violence in Gaza. So this is a gang that Israel stood up called Abu Shabaab, and they have Israeli weapons. We posted a video on our Twitter account, our main Twitter account. I won't play it because there's no dialogue, but this is a still from that video. As you can see, they roam around freely. This is Rafah. They run Rafah. Israel and these gangs run Rafah. They're ISIS affiliated, and they are ex or current, maybe even drug and human traffickers. Were you going to say something?
No, I was going to say that they literally propped them up, thinking that they would achieve all of their military aims and that this would be part of a transitional sort of, like, you know, they remind me of the Judenrat, wasn't it? The Jews that went and worked for the Nazis. And were either in the camps as guards or in the ghettos. They basically were like the ghetto police force. But they were ultimately collaborators. These are what these gangs, Abu Shabaab, this is what these gangs were doing, especially this one, Notorious, basically being the collaborator force for the occupying power. And now that the occupying power has, albeit retreated in a limited sense, now they're getting absolutely decimated by a reasserted control by Hamas and other resistance forces.
If you look in this photo, he's carrying a Zastava M92 carbine, which is a weapon often given by the Israelis to their collaborators and their settlers. So,
sadly provided by Serbia. Sadly, part of Serbia's guns and weapons dealings with the Israeli state.
Also, in the midst of all of this, while we've kind of been the headlines have been a little bit subdued about Israel constantly breaking the ceasefire this past week, another campaign started ramping up, which was this very hard anti-Islam campaign. So you guys will notice that these influencers are coming out in full force, blaming Hamas for the ceasefire, and obviously, you know, bringing all of Islam into the equation. We're sending our best.
I'm in Israel, and of course Hamas violated the peace deal. Now they're getting bombed. I get my popcorn ready. Let the fireworks begin.
These
She's
people.
A freak. I'm sorry. I'm gonna just throw it out there.
Freak. A total freak.
He's. You know what? As a crusader, neo crusader. She should pick up a weapon and go in there and fight. I'd like to see how long she lasts.
Seriously. She likes to shoot mannequins in the back of the head, though.
I know. She loves that.
This also came out. So realize this, and we've talked about it on our show quite a bit, about they weren't winning hearts and minds to get them to be pro-Israel. So what do they have to do? Elevate concerns that Hamas wants to destroy all Jews and spread jihadism. Israeli support rebounded by an average of over 20 points in each country. So their best tactic to combat the bad PR, according to the study, is to foment fear of radical Islam and jihadism.
We're back at the period 2001 to 2005-6. You know, we're back at the beginning of the war on terror. You know, nothing new under the sun, as they used to say. This is exactly the playbook. This is the playbook of the neocons. This was the playbook of Netanyahu back in those days. Play to the fears of radical Islam, the Iranian bomb, terrorists are lurking, migration. Everybody wants to bring Sharia law. You remember how that disappeared? And now it's all back. They want to do Sharia law. I'm like, well, what about Brooklyn, where they have kosher everywhere and they have their Talmud laws everywhere? You know? What is about that? You know? I don't mind their neighborhoods, but they are really. And now she's going to Michigan and she's saying, oh my God, there's a mosque. I said, yeah, there's a mosque. Okay, there's a mosque. There's how many churches and synagogues too? I mean, you know, the problem is they're trying to use this, and you see it's the connection is transnational, because she's doing it. Tommy Robinson's doing it. Tommy Robinson is also in Israel now.
In Israel, yeah.
He was in Jerusalem, going to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to be like, oh yeah, the Christian history, like a crusader's type over there. He doesn't know anything about Orthodoxy and the fact that the Orthodox Church is getting severely repressed by the Zionists. So I'm just saying that you have to look at this as part of an entire organic whole, that all these people that seemingly pop out of nowhere, they're all connected with this dark money that comes from the Zionist lobby and these free trips and all of these influential people that are going back and forth and spreading this stuff. And they're helping one another in this. She went over there to London to his rally.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. So people have to be aware of this and they have to be awake to it.
They really aren't like the greatest, they really aren't like our best influencers, though. I kind of am happy that Israel cultivates these relationships with people that we view as sort of like jokes. So it's like, okay, if you want to pay Valentina Gomez to go over there with her ridiculous accent and eating smart food popcorn, then by all means, like, do that, because I know she's going to be ineffective.
Well, yeah, of course. But you know, the problem is that they're playing to a demographic that is trying to also bridge the divide. That TPUSA crowd, you know, I mean, everything's connected here. The fact that you have a turn in TPUSA and amongst the youth, and now they're bringing this stuff to the youth as well. They're catering to it in TikTok style videos and short, you know, sound clips and bites, and trying to make it palatable and doing all these kinds of gimmicky things, like burning Qurans and things like that. They're trying to make it chic. And of course, they're also using sexual, you know, the sort of, you see a lot of these influencers using their sexuality and, you know, as if they're like OnlyFans models, but, you know, it's Zionist porn. That's what it is.
Zionist porn?
No, really. And what they're doing now is they're trying to get this disaffected youth that might have, you know, be on the fence or might be opening and critical, might be listening to Candace and Tucker and who knows what, and would have probably been on that turn towards America first and let's start criticizing Israel more. They're trying to wheel them back in. Oh, wait a second. Israel is a bulwark against Islam. Israel is a bulwark against jihad. If Israel falls, the gates, the gates of hell open to all of Europe and the rest of the world. That's what that's what they're saying.
Last I checked, Europe's gates were already open after the death of Gaddafi at the behest of Israel. So what's the difference if we...
Listen, the gates were opened by themselves. This is all part of the strategy, you know?
So the story that we got when I first woke up, which is about, I don't know, 8 a.m. my time, was that Hamas fired an anti-tank missile at Israeli troops from a tunnel in Rafah. Now, this comes after Israel already said, we control Rafah and so do our roving gangs. And so in response to this, Israel announced that Hamas had violated the ceasefire. And he shut down all crossings, including Rafah.
Right.
So then they strike Gaza with 20 airstrikes across Rafah and the entire strip. And Hamas responded by saying, we are not aware of any incidents or clashes taking place in Rafah. Contact has been severed with our groups that remain there as Israel controls it. But who is in Rafah? So it's like, okay, we see this sort of narrative building that Israel likes to do. So, and behind the scenes, Israel informed the United States before launching the airstrikes via the U.S.-run command center monitoring the truce. Mm-hmm. Who else was involved? Of course, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. Why they're involved in Israel striking Gaza, I have no effing clue. Do you have any? Why are these men anywhere near this?
They're involved because they're part of the special envoy. They basically have a special status as government representatives of the United States to Israel as part of this coordination and command center that they have set up there. So they basically are like the presidential, not even ambassadors, because they're not full ambassadors. They're basically the special advisors on this issue. They have a special set of tasks, and they are not in any way, there's no oversight over them, except by the president himself. So they're only under the executive authority, and they have that special privilege. And so that's why they're there. That's why probably also doing business deals on the side, but they're there for that specific reason.
So now I lost my own train of thought. Oh, Witkoff and Kushner also did an interview this week. I'm just going to play one clip of it, but it's pretty horrendous.
We woke up the next morning to find out that there had been this attack. And of course, I was called by the president.
You had no idea, obviously.
None whatsoever. You know, I think both Jared and I felt, I just feel we felt a little bit betrayed.
Now, I had heard that the president, that he was furious.
I think he felt like the Israelis were getting a little bit out of control in what they were doing, and that it was time to be very strong and stop them from doing things that he felt were not in their long-term interests.
People should understand that Netanyahu, the Israelis, bombed the peacemakers, bombed the negotiating team.
And by the way, Leslie, it had a metastasizing effect because the Qataris were critical to the negotiation, as were the Egyptians and the Turks. And we had lost the confidence of the Qataris. Right. And so Hamas went underground, and it was very, very difficult to get to them. And
they were your link to Hamas.
Absolutely.
You were dealing through the Qataris to make your proposals to Hamas.
And it became very, very evident as to how important and how critical that role was.
Nothing makes any sense. So you felt betrayed that Israel tried to bomb the Hamas negotiators in Qatar, but you're advising them to bomb Gaza at the same time without even real verification that the ceasefire was even violated by Hamas.
And let's be honest, how are they taken by surprise when there's a whole set of command and coordination that's going on behind the scenes? I mean, I just think that this is also just show.
Yeah, well, my theory is that they did know, and they were like, you know what, screw it, just go ahead and do whatever. And then it happened, and then Qatar was like, we're going to pull our investments if you guys keep fucking around. And then now they have to be like, this was horrible, blah, blah, blah. And then they gave them that hookup at the base in Idaho.
Exactly.
That's how I'm kind of seeing it. So, and here's just a taste of what Kushner, I guess, authorized. We're being told that the United States advised Israel, go ahead and retaliate, but do it proportionately. That's the response to an anti-tank weapon assault in Rafah.
Crazy. Crazy. And not only, I think there were, if the numbers are correct, there were hundreds of missile and bomb strikes today.
Over 100. I think 120 at last I checked. Yeah.
120. I mean, that's an insane number. That's talk about proportionality. For one, supposedly, I don't know. I haven't seen the evidence. Anti-tank round. To have 120 give or take strikes. And a lot of dead civilians.
An article came out in Axios today. I suggest you guys read it, but some of the quotes are really fantastic from the U.S. officials, such as, "We are now in charge of what's going on in Gaza when it comes to the implementation of the deal. We are going to be calling the shots."
Interesting.
One senior U.S. official said, "Now the real work begins. There is a need for people who know how to run a municipality, how to build a water sewer plant and run it, local government people. It's a huge challenge." Where's the transition team? Not to mention you're continuously bombing the people who in Gaza who could be the experts to run your municipality.
And not only that, I just heard that they've now closed humanitarian aid. Mm-hmm. They've closed all the humanitarian aid corridors as well. So now it's, again, siege.
Bibi submitted, today I am submitting for government approval the proposal to give the war a permanent official name. The War of Redemption. At the end of 2 years of continuous fighting, we remember how we started. We rose up from the terrible disaster of October 7th. We rose up on our feet dynamically and returned intensive war to our enemies. We removed the existential threat of the Iranian axis from us, and we established the National Redemption Project in the land of Israel in our strong, flourishing state.
You know all the people who lost family members? I mean, that's the next generation of fighters. You think everyone's just going to stop fighting now? You think that all these people who've suffered, that's it? No. If this is the war of redemption, get ready for revenge of the orphans. Really, get ready for revenge of the orphans. It's coming. Might not come this year, next year, but give it another couple years, 5, 10 years, few decades. Trust me, there's no redemption here. There's nothing like that.
Now here's where it gets. Now, this is the, I think, third person to report this, but this is coming from Ryan Grimm, who obviously is head of DropSite, which we cite often, and I find them to be an incredibly good resource. He tweeted, "Soon after the explosion in Rafah, I'm told by a source familiar, the White House and Pentagon knew that the incident was caused by an Israeli settler bulldozer running over unexploded ordnance, contradicting Netanyahu's claim that Hamas popped up from tunnels. After Netanyahu said he was blocking all aid from entering Gaza in response and unleashed a bombing campaign, the administration conveyed to Israel that they knew what had happened. Netanyahu then announced he would reopen the crossings in a few hours." Why are we playing cat and mouse with these fucking people?
You know the main issue is that nobody's going to be held accountable because there's no institution that can hold these people accountable for these kinds of crimes. They're just if you want to talk about a rogue, these are the two rogue powers in the world. Nobody can hold them to account. They do what they want. They kill and maim, and they can commit genocide and no penalty. There's no Nuremberg for them. There's no Tokyo war trials for them. Nothing. In fact, more money, more investment, more business deals, anything you want. Sky's the limit.
Here's Trump once again today. I don't know if this is a slip up or he just doesn't know that he's telling the world the truth. I don't know what he's doing, but here.
Beautiful. It could be developed. And you said you wanted to develop it.
Well,
do you have plans for that?
Not me as an individual.
U.S.
I liked it as like Freedom Place. You call it Freedom Place. And we would get all of the people that live there into decent homes throughout the region. If you look, Egypt has a lot of land. Jordan has a lot of land, you know, right next door. A lot of countries have a lot of land. So I had an initial vision that we would get them. Look at Gaza. I mean, you know, there's nothing standing. The whole thing is, it's all rubble. So it's not too hard to top that. Israel can say that we killed 50,000. And so you'd say it's a whole new set of people. And it is. I mean, you know, they get replaced by other people, young people.
Remember, so remember that replacement thing I just talked about? Yeah. Exactly.
So they want to name it Freedom. What did he call it? Freedom Place?
Freedom, but what?
Gaza is going to be named Freedom Place.
Are we back? We are back in the early 2000s. Freedom Fries. We're there. God, nothing new under the sun, really. It's just so strange.
We've talked about this a few times, saying like we thought we saw like a condensation of all of the hot button issues over the last two decades being brought into the last year. And here's, yeah, we're just back to Islamophobia. I guess you know when you know what works, you just go back to the
of course.
Same things that worked.
It's so crazy. The problem is that you can't put the genie back in the bottle in this sense, and the people are awake more so than they were back then. At least one would hope so. And I think statistics are proving that. But if any statistics are correct, you can try to bridge that gap with this propaganda and try to get that 10-20% that you can win back. That's the problem. And then it becomes a partisan issue again down the line. I just don't know. I don't know. People are awake. People are noticing. People are seeing. People are understanding. There's a little bit more. I think that people have seen enough images of 2 years of this genocide that they are more than not understanding of what the root causes are and who's the perpetrator and the oppressor and the one causing the harm, you know?
Yeah, we'll keep you guys updated, obviously, on the Gaza situation, but I highly recommend you guys kind of stay glued to it and hold people accountable and continue to talk about what's actually going on. The ceasefire was broken again 41 minutes after it began, and they're just kind of pretending that today is like the actual, this is the one that counts, I guess. I'm not really sure. But not to give you guys a hard transition here, but I do want to introduce our guest. This is, you guys may or may not know him, Scott from Calibrated. Now, we still call him Scott. Are we allowed to call him by his real name? I don't know. But either way, he's actually started DDG with me. Me, my producer, and Scott were like the three original founders. And so I'm so happy to welcome you today to finally give us a battlefield update, because I refuse to do them. And it's just actually really good to see you. So welcome to the show, Scott. Thank you so much for joining us. And I don't know if you've met Chris, but here is Christopher Hilali.
Welcome, Scott.
I don't think I've met Chris. It's nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you.
Yeah. There's a ton to talk about. I'm very grateful to be here and for you to have me on. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. So let's start with the Trump-Putin call.
Yeah.
Before the Zelensky meeting. What do you feel? How do you feel about the call between the two of them? Do you think that they discussed, there's a meme going around. It's kind of funny that he said, I'm going to send tomahawks. Putin says, you're not going to send tomahawks. Trump says, I'm not going to send tomahawks. What do you think was discussed on that call? How do you think it went? And how do you think the relationship between Trump and Putin is actually going right now?
You know, I the way I look at it is it's always Putin is always doing something on the periphery to stroke Trump's ego. That's how it always feels. In terms of the negotiation standpoint, Russia's position hasn't changed since Istanbul in 2022, and it's not going to weaken any. And that's really the position that Ukraine is not able to accept and Europe is not able to accept. And the U.S. doesn't want to accept it. We're making tons of money off of our military industrial complex sending arms and stuff to Ukraine. So there's not really a rush to end the war. There is no need to end the war on the Western side. They want Ukraine fighting Russia, bogging Russia down for as long as possible. And when it comes to this phone call, this is sort of, I think people have ignored a real red line. We talk about Russian red lines quite frequently, but a lot of the red lines that were brought up were sort of fake and just, used as propaganda saying, oh, look, we crossed this Russian red line. They didn't do anything. Sending Abrams and, Leo tanks to Ukraine is not necessarily crossing a Russian red line. It is an escalation. It doesn't make them happy, but this isn't something that is going to cause an international incident. there is something that could be sent that would cause an international incident, and that would be a Tomahawk cruise missile. We've seen other versions of these missiles, not exact same missile, but the same sort of category of missile, long-range cruise missiles, being offered or threatened to be sent to Ukraine. This includes, but not limited to, the Taurus and the JASSM missiles. Both of these weapon systems had been previously mentioned, talked about being sent to Ukraine, and then at the end of the day, they weren't actually sent, because this is an actual Russian red line. This is something that I'm fairly certain they have made very clear cannot be sent. But regardless of what the Russians think, I don't think that necessarily would stop the West from doing something they see as beneficial to their position. I think the major, major issue is that the U.S. just has no capacity and logistics capability to actually supply these weapon systems to Ukraine and maintain their own defensive capabilities or their own offensive capabilities if they needed to use these weapon systems in the future. There's also the problem of launch systems. You would need a ground-based launch system, which it does exist in theory. But in terms of practice, in terms of actual quantity of said ground launch systems, it would basically have to be something that is designed and catered for Ukraine to use these weapons against Russia. And if we got these weapons to Ukraine, they would only get between 100 and 200 of these missiles, which we've seen with ATACMS, we've seen with Storm Shadow, just doesn't really change anything on the ground. So it's escalation for escalation's sake. And I think the Trump administration clearly sees that, and they're backing away from this. I don't necessarily know if it has anything to do with the Putin-Trump phone call. I think that this wasn't going to happen before that phone call was made. I think that this is just one of those wonder weapon talking points that the pro-Ukrainian crowd likes to stick to.
I agree. And I think that kind of comes through when Trump's answering questions about Tomahawks.
Putin tried to dissuade you from selling Tomahawk missiles.
Well, of course. What do you think he's going to say? Please sell Tomahawks? No, but is he going to say, please sell those Tomahawks? I really appreciate it. I did actually say, would you mind if I gave a couple of thousand Tomahawks to your opposition? I did say that to him. I said it just that way. He didn't like the idea. He really didn't like the idea. No, I said it that way. You have to be a little bit lighthearted sometimes, but no, he doesn't want Tomahawk is a vicious weapon. It's a vicious, offensive, incredibly destructive weapon. Nobody wants Tomahawks shot at him. We talked about it a little bit, didn't say much, but I do say to you, we need Tomahawks for the United States of America, too. We have a lot of them, but we need them. I mean, we can't deplete for our country. So, they're very vital. They're very powerful. They're very accurate. They're very good, but we need them too.
You've depleted so many stocks for Ukraine. All of a sudden, it's the Tomahawks is where the line goes.
Yeah, well, in the same clip, I mean, two different parts of the same clip, you hear him talk about how he's threatening to send thousands of Tomahawk cruise missiles, but in the next breath says, well, the U.S. actually needs these weapons. Where are these thousands of Tomahawks going to come from? Because if you're going to send those, I mean, I might be wrong here, but that might be almost the entirety of the U.S. Tomahawk missile stockpile that he's talking about there. And that's clearly the reason why they can't send it. So, I mean, how I've taken Trump's words for the last 8 months, I just ignore them. It's all bluster. It's all theater. It's all nonsense. If you want to know what he's going to do, read policy papers or just ignore what he says and just watch the actions and follow the money, because he's going to, what, 2 weeks ago, September 24th, he put out that post on Truth Social saying that Ukraine is going to win. They're going to be able to take back their territory and more. And then today he comes out and there's that, it's either the Financial Times or Washington Post or somebody put out an article saying that basically Trump, in the conversation with Zelensky in Washington this week, said that he needs to concede and they need to give up or they're going to be destroyed by Russia. So every 2 weeks it changes. We don't know which direction it's going to go. But what we do know is what Pete Hegseth said in February in Brussels. And what he said then was that the U.S. is going forward with the division of labor. This is our policy moving forward. Europe will take over the Ukraine project. The fighting will continue. U.S. arms will be transferred to Ukraine through Europe, through NATO. NATO is going to take over that liability. The U.S. is going to focus on the Middle East, potentially Venezuela, and pivot hard to China.
Yeah. I lost my train of thought. Oh, there it is. Both. This is a question for both of you. So we keep hearing, you know, Zelensky, everything is a game changer. What's the condition of the actual front of the war? How are the Russians doing on the ground? What's the morale like? And the same goes for Chris, you're in Moscow. Do people still support the war? And, you know, as we get to go into yet another winter where, you know, things kind of go into a lull in the winter, are people okay with sticking this out, that sort of thing?
Go ahead, Chris, Scott.
Go ahead. You can go ahead, Chris.
No, listen, I mean, the people that I speak to are very supportive of achieving all the goals. Listen, a lot of blood has been given. A lot has been sacrificed by Russia and the Russian people. And I think that if you were to divide, of course, you have the liberals who are not as vocal as they once were, but they are saying, of course, it's time to wind down and this and that. And I think you can kind of see these two positions with like Kirill Dmitriev and Medvedev as sort of the two people who kind of have the hardline position and sort of the more open approach to the U.S., especially for reestablishing economic relations. Both have their place here. But certainly, I think that in most Russians' minds, the ending of the special military operation has to be on Russia's terms. And it cannot be a situation where Russia concedes anything because, as Putin and others have rightfully pointed out, they have hundreds of thousands of veterans now from the special military operation coming back into Russian life in key strategic jobs. They're going to have the ability to get into government positions. And of course, we cannot forget about the ghosts of Kiev. You have the real ghost of Prigozhin that still sort of looms amongst the hardline crowd, basically saying, we did all of this and there were failures in leadership. So people are going to demand that heads roll if it goes the wrong direction. For example, there was a report today saying that Zaporozhye and Kherson might be given up. I mean, I cannot see any possibility where that could happen and heads won't roll for that. Not to mention, of course, the hardliners still talk about Odessa and the need to go to Prednestrovye. If the conditions are set where the special military operation ends, Prednestrovye will become the next battlefield. And if there's a humanitarian catastrophe where hundreds of thousands of Russians have to be evacuated from there, or a new front opens up that leads to a catastrophe because it's completely surrounded without access to the Black Sea, I think that that's going to also play very badly and poorly to especially the Russian population. So there's such a very delicate balancing act that needs to happen here. But certainly I think that Russians I speak to, especially the vets that I served alongside in Syria, they're saying it needs to end on our terms. And it needs to end where the root conditions are addressed, as Putin always says. And unless that happens, I cannot foresee a situation where that does happen. Now, of course, there could be the possibility, and I'd like Scott's opinion on this. There is some murmuring that the U.S. is going to try to pivot and wash its hands of it and try to reopen economic ties a la Kirill Dmitriev and try to kind of do the bilateral relation reset without having to do the reset in Europe. But I don't know how that's going to work if the U.S. is the main arms dealer through which NATO is sending, in Europe, sending the arms to Ukraine. And so the U.S. becomes a clearinghouse. I don't know, but there's going to be some palatable solution that they're going to try to figure out for that. I don't know what's going to end up happening, but certainly the mood is that we're winning on the front. I also want to say that the Russia air superiority has been established now. There's a progressively greater and greater impact of Russia air superiority. And that's one thing that was lacking at the start of the special military operation was control of Ukrainian airspace by Russian military forces and air force forces. If that gets established now, I think it's going to be a real game changer.
You're muted. He always does that.
Sorry, I was trying not to make noise while I wasn't talking. I would tend to agree with most of that. I am of the opinion now, and I know this was a little bit different, that we are in a completely different geopolitical landscape. I don't think that the post-Soviet world order exists anymore. I don't think that that's how the world goes about its business. And when you talk about the U.S. trying to reopen trade relations with Russia, I definitely see that as a possibility. I think we're so wishy-washy on how we see this going forward. We're sort of at a dead end and we're looking for off ramps. We're looking for the best way out. We're looking to salvage this in any way we can, because the original goal was to destroy the Russian economy with sanctions, right? That didn't happen. Now we're just buying time. We're just trying to figure out how we want to get out of this thing. And you're right that the European market and the Russian market will probably never be reconnected. And that is what this whole thing was about. It's a reason why we blew up Nord Stream. I mean, that's very, very clear. We do not want Europe under the Russian energy thumb, I guess you would say. Even though that is technically good for Europe. In terms of what's happening on the ground, you are correct in that the Russians are now dominating in terms of deep strike capability. I would not necessarily say that they have air superiority. Not air supremacy. They are not able to directly fly over Ukraine, but not so much because they can't, because they're worried about individual Ukrainian air defense systems being brought up to the front to then pick them off. We see this sometimes with Patriot here and there. But relatively speaking, Russian airframes have relative safety now when they're conducting sorties. So this includes glide bombs and missiles like the KH-59, KH-69 cruise missile. And this has definitely had a major impact, not just this, but in correlation with that, you also have increased Iskander accuracy, production, everything. ISR is better. Russian reconnaissance is way, way better than it was at the beginning of the war. Russia didn't have FPV drones at the beginning of the war. Now they have both fiber optic and FPV drones. They have reconnaissance drones that carry FPV drones 30, 40, 50 kilometers behind Ukrainian lines, which is now disrupting the logistics heavily. Not only that, but on top of all of those Russian advantages, the attrition that we've been talking about for 3 years now is absolutely coming into effect, and it can be seen across the map. I'm going to take you guys over to my map. This is the calibrated Ukraine frontline battle map, and I'm just going to show you a few areas where the Ukrainians are really experiencing a lot of heavy manpower issues and the Russians are advancing steadily. So all of the green you see on my map is advances made since Monday, just for your own mental processing there, so you can see sort of how the Russians are advancing. Down here in the Zaporozhye Dnipropetrovsk region, so this is one of the oblasts that the Russians had not originally entered. It is not one of the four original oblasts mentioned in negotiations. This is a new area right here, this orange, that the Russians have entered, and they have already penetrated about 35 to 40 kilometers into this oblast here, which directly borders the Zaporozhye region and the village of Holyaypolye. This is an area that everybody should be watching if you follow the front line very closely. This is a crossroad village, as I can call it. It has a number of road and highway connections. Very, very important. And there's just really no solid Ukrainian line out here anymore. We've experienced throughout this war, months where a line might not move. And that's just because the Ukrainians had such strong defensive capabilities, intertwined with drone capabilities, made it very difficult for the Russians to move. That's not what we're seeing anymore. A 3 to 4 kilometer advance in a single event is now commonplace in this region. So this is a massive change of pace for this territory. Russian control of Dnipropetrovsk is continuously expanding. You hear a lot about the city of Pokrovsk, and that is very important because, again, it is one of these places that can be used by the Russians for staging and expansion out. I call this the Pokrovsk flower. I'm going to bring up a prediction right here, and you guys will see after the fall of the city of Pokrovsk in Minhorod, which is currently being fought over, the Ukrainians regularly find themselves in these encirclements. As you can see, the only way to get in is through this narrow little gap right here, which is constantly covered by Russian artillery, drones, and glide munitions. So, you know, getting into this area alone is a nightmare. We've seen something like 30 or 40 vehicles in one video destroyed in this location alone. So this is a death trap for the Ukrainians, much like Bakhmut was. And it is just continuously draining the Ukrainian manpower pool. So this is a very, very important city that is now in its final days of battle. And behind it, we can see that there is really nothing for the Ukrainians to defend until they reach Pulvahad. So after the fall of Pokrovsk, expect a giant Russian expansion into the eastern portion of the Donetsk Oblast. Russian forces have also entered the city of Kostantinivka, which is just to the north of Pokrovsk. It is another very important city that lies in the Kramatorsk-Slavyansk defensive belt. The fact that the Russians entered the city is pretty major just because we don't usually see the Russians just kind of walk into cities. Usually they have to surround the city, put a ton of pressure on the logistics, and then they're able to enter. Again, this just speaks to the really, really difficult conditions that the AFU is currently fighting under in Ukraine. I'm going to go just up here north where we can talk about Seversk. This is an area that has seen very little movement for the entirety of the war. Now, in the last couple of months, we have seen the Russians completely surround the city of Seversk. It is divided by the Bakhmutivka River here, so it is isolated. Again, another tactical encirclement for the Ukrainians. Moving up to the north, this is the Kremena-Liman direction. If any of our history buffs in here remember, during 2022, the Ukrainian counteroffensive ripped through this portion of territory. Here is Izum, here is Kharkov, here is Kupiansk. This entire area was the grand Ukrainian 2022 counteroffensive. All of that is now being undone. And as you can see, the Russians have again semi-encircled another city. I'm going to bring up this line back here so you guys can see. This orange line is representative of the Severodonetsk River. This river is at the back of the Liman garrison, so they will have to cross river crossings to keep this area supplied. These river crossings are constantly bombed by Russian aviation, and all of the roads in and out are under Russian drone control. Expect Liman to fall quickly now that the Russians are at the gates of the city. Finally, up in the north, we have Kupiansk. Kupiansk is a very, very unique battle in this war. Again, it was one of the major achievements of the Ukrainian 2022 counteroffensive. And as we can see, the Russians had crossed the Oskil River here to the north and have completely captured the right bank of the city of Kupiansk. The city is divided by the Oskil River. The eastern bank of the river here is still partially under Ukrainian control, although logistics into this pocket is going to be very tight. Again, expect another expansion out of Kupiansk, another flower. And if I can bring up one more prediction here, this little particular area, this northern corner of Kharkov, I would pay very close attention to it. We have continued Russian advances now in the Vovochansk region, which is an area, again, we have not seen any advances in for quite some time. Another sign that Ukrainian manpower is just not available. They are very thinly spread out. And where the Russians choose to push, they are achieving success. This is a completely different war than what we saw in 2022, 2023, 2024. This is a completely different Russian army. Thank you. You're
fantastic. Really fantastic. Really
Everybody in the comments was raving, so we'll have to keep bringing him on to do our map update. That was really excellent.
It's great. It's great. Far more detailed than the live UA map I sometimes go to, and I'm like, oh, where's the detail here?
You know? Yeah, it's maps that don't, you know, they... Some maps will just like draw lines and it doesn't follow the land at all, doesn't follow the topography. Correct. And it just is just confusing. It makes everything harder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But very, very detailed. And I think that you're absolutely right. I have a question for you. So do you think, are we reaching in every major conflict of this kind in history, at some point, one side eventually will start to lose the momentum of defenses and there's going to be a gradual but progressive falling of their defensive capabilities to allow for a major push by the opposing force. Do you see that we're getting to that point, or we're already at the cusp of that? That Ukrainians are at this point, they're really on their heels at this point, and they're moving backwards at this point.
Yeah, no, that's very clear. I think it's, to me, what it looks like on the battlefield is a matter of Russian will, how the Russians want to execute and move forward. If they, just for the audience sake, guys, remember, when you're moving fast, there is a higher propensity for casualties. There's a higher propensity for mistakes. This goes for any army in any situation. When you blitz through any given line, you expose yourself to attack. You expose yourself to weakness. The Russians have committed to this attrition style war. It is very slow. It is arduous. It doesn't look like a ton on the map. But what is happening behind the scenes is the destruction of an army. And when that army is finally destroyed to the point that it is now, what you're seeing now, the Russians will begin to advance more quickly, just where the Ukrainians aren't able to defend. So when we're talking about some big offensive, I don't know if the Russians want to do that. Right. The war is not going bad for them. They are able to maintain the current pace indefinitely. The Russian economy is in a stable position. So why give the enemy an opportunity that they didn't previously have? Now, if you assess the risk and it's you look at it and you go, well, we're going to get all this territory and they're not going to be able to destroy us or, you know, catch us out or anything like that. But if you want a big arrow offensive, that comes with casualties and that comes with risks. And I don't think the Russians really want to hand over to the Ukrainians an opportunity to get a win anywhere on the battlefield. The Ukrainians are losing across the battlefield, guys. They're not winning in their deep strike war against Russian refineries. I think it's something like 39 Russian refineries have been hit in the last like 13 months or something like that, which anything past 6 months has probably been repaired. So in terms of actually degrading the Russian, you know, energy economy, that's not happening. Meanwhile, Ukraine has lost something like 70% of its domestic gas refining and storage. So there's really no comparison. And yes, we are reaching that point where I don't know if Russians are going to do it or if the Ukrainians are just going to kind of collapse in on themselves, because at a certain point, they're going to stop fighting. When you're losing left, you're losing right, it's clear you're going to lose. People are just not going to fight anymore. And I think that's more likely to be the case than some massively staged Russian offensive that, you know, takes 3 or 4 oblasts at any given time or anything like that. I've always said, when it comes to the question like Odessa, Sumy, Kharkov, these places, yes, you might see the Russians go in. Yes, you might see these areas taken, but it's always going to be in the larger aim of degrading the Ukrainian military. Places like Odessa, Nikolaev, Dnepropetrovsk, all, you know, Zaporozhye City, these places will likely be taken, but they will probably not be taken with, you know, direct military force against the standing Ukrainian army. I would just wait until they're not there anymore.
Scott, I was going to ask you, because I'm speaking with, you know, our friends here. We have many of them and they, you know, a lot of analysts and things like that. They're saying that even Russia doesn't necessarily have to fight a war in Odessa city itself. It can take a lot of that fertile land, some of that farmland and open land above Odessa and kind of siege Odessa from the top side, and then play the diplomatic cards to basically create a neutral buffer and then try to slowly take control of it in that way. I don't know what's the goal, but Odessa remains as one of the biggest question marks in people's minds here.
Yeah,
what's happening with Odessa?
I would just say that I would just not expect any major crossing of the river until it's almost like a diplomatic solution.
Really?
I really don't think that there's any need for the Russians to go about the, you know, they don't need to cross and then conquer all of that territory when the entire Ukrainian army is sitting in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, right? Yeah. You don't need to send Marine brigades across a river into a Krinky style, you know, mess where they, again, offering the Ukrainians an opportunity to win. This is just you're playing a game, as maniacal and cynical as that is to say, you are playing a game of chess and you do not want to expose yourself to a checkmate when you're winning, when you have all the pieces, right? So just keep, I think that the Russians are just going to keep going the way that they're going. And I think you're going to see this war end in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. I don't think there will be a Ukrainian army to fall back on.
Well, you mentioned collapsing. Let's check in with Zelensky. He did an interview today. Zelensky and Trump create so much content. Neither of them ever stop talking. It's such a nightmare trying to keep up with them. But here's Zelensky today.
And I'm honest, it's good that President Trump didn't say no, but for today didn't say yes.
He didn't say yes to Tomahawk missiles.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is a sensitive question, and messages from President that it's not enough for American interests, the number of you.
What is the hang up on the Tomahawks? Is this another game changer, Reno? What are we doing here?
It's just an excuse. It's just a distraction like everything else. There, you know, he's not talking about what's happening in Pokrovsk. He's not talking about Kupiansk. He's not talking about the front line at all. What is he talking about? He's talking about Western weapons. He's talking about more money. It's just a game, right? Ukraine is just a proxy. This is all that they are. And all that Zelensky is a puppet. And he's learning very quickly what becomes of U.S. proxies. This is just the way that it goes. Every single proxy, every single ally of the United States thinks that they're somehow different, somehow better, somehow above the Saigon rooftop, the Kabul, on the rooftop in Afghanistan, sort of evacuation, episode that happens to all U.S. proxies. This is just what happens. You are used, and then when you're no longer viable to be used anymore, you're thrown away. And what is the U.S. doing? Wiping our hands of that liability. That's Europe's problem now, right? Whatever happens to Ukraine, we tried. We tried to make peace. We had Putin in Alaska. They didn't want it. You know, our proxy who we're funding and giving all of our weapons to, they wanted to keep fighting. They wanted it. So we don't have to take responsibility. It's just like what's happening in Gaza and with Israel and Gaza, right? Israel can't do that without our F-35s, our F-16s, our JDAMs, our fuel. Their economy is smaller than New Jersey's. It's like they're not doing it. We're allowing all of it to happen. Same thing goes with Ukraine. So the Tomahawks, it's just another distraction. It's just something that can take the attention away from the disaster that is unfolding directly beneath them. And they all know it. And part of the reason that this disaster is happening right now, the way it is happening, is because of the massive amount of corruption within the Ukrainian military and within the Ukrainian political regime. You're talking to the soldiers on the front line in Ukraine, and they're talking about how Kupiansk isn't even set up for defense. They've had years holding that city and they've not defended. They haven't set up infrastructure for defense. Where did all that money go? Like, it went somewhere. It's in somebody's pocket, probably out of country. And now the Ukrainians are sitting around just trying to figure out what's going on. So, the Tomahawks, again, it's just a wonder weapon. And we've talked about wonder weapons since HIMARS was delivered. did HIMARS, HIMARS is probably the weapon system that Ukraine got that actually made some sort of impact on the battlefield. But ATACMS, Storm Shadow, I think we've seen, two Flamingo missiles be fired. And that was supposed to be, that was like 3 weeks ago. They were talking about Flamingo this, Flamingo that. It's just another distraction and excuse to not talk about what's happening on the front line. And it's a good one, right? I mean, you got Ukraine battle maps and who else, big Twitter accounts. That all they talk about is Tomahawks. I'm like, guys, you want to make a map? You want to show what's happening to the Ukrainian army? No, because that's not good for...
Well, that would show that Tomahawks wouldn't do it. Yeah. They show. One more before I let you go. I don't want to take too much of your time. You mentioned the comparison to Gaza, the similarities that you see between the two. Zelensky also sees some, maybe not the same as us, but I want your comments on this.
Part of President Trump's success with Israel and Hamas was that he applied pressure to all sides. Does President Trump need to get tougher with President Putin?
Yes, and even more, because Putin is something similar, but more strong than Hamas. Mm. It's more bigger war, and he is the second army in the world. And That's why more pressure.
Putin is Hamas.
Putin is Hamas.
If we could convince Trump that Putin is Hamas, we could get him back in the game.
Putin's Hitler, Putin's Hamas, yeah. Putin's this, that, he's a Tsar. Who knows? He's everything.
Not only is he Hitler and Hamas, but he's also the second army in Ukraine and the second best army in the world at the same time. It's the Schrodinger's Russia, where at the same time they can't conquer Ukraine, and they should have conquered Ukraine in a week, but also they're coming for Berlin. Guys, Warsaw is on the table for Putin whenever he wants. He can just stroll in. His drones just fly into the country at will. So, it's just this ridiculous position where you have to have a boogeyman, right? But also, you can't convince everybody to go fight that boogeyman if they think it's really the boogeyman and they're going to get killed for it, right? So it's this, like I always say, Schrodinger's Russia. You never know if they're actually strong or weak, because we can never decide on our propaganda. But when we're talking about that clip, first and foremost, what pressure did we put on Bibi to end the conflict? What I mean, outside of the international hatred that Israel is gardening for a genocide that they're committing, I don't know what pressure we put on them. We blocked everything in the UN Security Council. We protect them in and out. So don't know where that whole put pressure on both sides came from. Also, they just completely disregarded the ceasefire. Also, there's supposed to be a ceasefire in southern Lebanon, which is not being observed at all. So I don't know who's still making deals with the United States. It's ridiculous. This is also a thing I have with Russia, where I don't think Putin is really making any deals with anybody. I think he's just telling the West what needs to happen. And if they're not going to do it, the war is just going to continue. And that doesn't really work for Trump's position at all. So what was there a specific question that you asked with that clip?
I just wanted your reaction. And then one last thing. What do you think about the possibility of them going to Hungary and Orban being the mediator? Trump loves Orban. He loves Orban.
What is it going to accomplish? What has changed for the Ukrainians? What has changed for NATO? What has changed for the United States? Has anything changed? The first thing that you would see is sanctions relief. That would be the first sign that something is changing. Less pressure on the competitors who are buying Russian oil. You see how much emphasis we're putting on India right now, and how much pressure we're putting on them to stop buying Russian oil, which they're refusing to do. We're threatening China with 500% tariffs for buying Russian oil. And this just really speaks to the underlying policy. And this is what I always talk about, is don't listen to words. Don't follow the negotiation theater. Istanbul was fake. Alaska Trump Putin meeting was fake. It's just to buy time. It's just to try to get some sort of diplomatic propaganda win. You know, the Russians are playing the same game that the United States is playing, where they go to these meetings and they pretend to be willing to do this or pretend to be willing to do that. And it's just to kind of keep up the appearance. But like I've said, I think that the geostrategic thinking is now completely different than it was even 10 years ago. I think we're more in a global war situation, where that's our mindset. We are now fighting tooth and nail everywhere we go. You know, we're killing Venezuelans extrajudiciously just because we want to build up this narrative of a terrorist organization that Maduro is running now since May. Like, what the hell are we talking about? We give a Nobel Peace Prize to the opposition leader, but we're forgetting about our boy Juan Guaido chilling in Miami. Like, come on, don't forget the OGs, right? It just doesn't add up, and it doesn't make sense. So just don't listen to the talk. Don't listen to Zelensky. What did he say? It's not a yes, but it's not a no. Well, it's not a no, but it's not a yes. What are you talking about, dude? That's a no.
Like, dumber and dumber. They're dumb and dumber. So you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah, so there's always a chance, right? We might still get those Taurus missiles that we tried to get a year and a half ago, and we were turned down for the exact same reason. And they knew they weren't going to get it. But again, it's something to talk about other than Kupiansk. It's something to talk about other than Pokrovsk. It's something to talk about other than Dnipropetrovsk Oblast, where you're losing hundreds of square kilometers. It's just something better than reality.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Scott. It was Fantastic having you on.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Scott.
Please tell everybody where you're at and when they can find you.
Yeah. You guys can find me on YouTube at Calibrated. Calibrated with Scott. I do live streams over there. I also post videos of my map updates, and I do interviews with different people in this information space. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is Aiden over there. I have a very big Twitter, and then my Telegram is Calibrated. And if you go to the link of any of my YouTube videos, you can find all of those links to everywhere you can find me.
Thank you again, Scott. And thank you so much for helping me build this, whatever this is.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Would love to
thank
have you.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. We're not done yet. I won't keep you too long.
There's more.
But wait, there's more. Everybody's complaining about it. A Giuliani visiting Russia.
Между нашими странами за многие десятилетия сложились особые отношения. Свыше 80 лет мы поддерживаем дипломатические связи, причем они были установлены в самые трудные для России, для Советского Союза времена в 1944 году. На это время отношения между Сирией и Россией всегда носили исключительно дружеский характер. У нас в России никогда в отношении Сирии не было никаких каких-то отношений, связанных с нашей политической конъюнктурой или с особыми интересами. Мы всегда руководствовались на протяжении всех этих десятилетий одним интересами сирийского народа.
Everybody says they're sad and they're mad, but you guys, I'm the number one Putin shill, right? Let me spin this. So look at what he said. He said about the relations. I'm interested in what's best for the Syrian people. Yada, yada, yada. They have 80 years of relations, and this head chopper, whatever you want to call him, isn't going to make Russia A, leave their bases, and B, leave the Syrian people. What was this meeting actually about? And this is why I want you guys to stop talking shit and stop being sad. Turn that frown upside down. This is why they were really there. Giuliani wants Russia to deploy to Syria to stop the Israeli encroachments. And for that, Giuliani will give Russia part and parcel guarantees to all of their bases. They want Moscow's backing to resist Israel's demand for a wider demilitarized zone. Interesting. Chris, what do you think about that?
Listen, it was a big topic. I was at RT's 20th anniversary gala, and it was the talk of the town because it just happened a few days before. A lot of veterans there, a lot of medals. We saw a lot of heroes who fought in Syria. And I myself was in Syria for nearly a year, spent a lot of time there, know a lot of people there, lost a lot of comrades there. So, of course, listen, on one side, there's the emotional side. On the other side, listen, Russia thinks not necessarily in tomorrow's terms, but in decades. Giuliani won't stay there forever. I think that there's a lot of talk that new political realities will emerge in the coming months and years in Syria. Will Syria remain a united country is still a talk that many people are having. Will it fragment? Will it balkanize? Will there be an Alawite Druze state, an Alawite Christian state? Will the Kurds break off? Will Turkey allow that? What's Israel's role here? What's the broader political game? Where's the US and Russia and all of this factored in? I think that ultimately Russia sees the two bases as being key to their strategic interests. Don't forget, Russia, unlike the United States, does not have 800 foreign military bases. They have less than 30. So these two bases are even that much more valuable, and they've invested a lot of blood and treasure. And Russia says, okay, you know, I want people to put this in perspective. Trump and his policies have killed more Russians than Giuliani and Al-Qaeda. If you think about it, in the fact that the Trump administration in the first term and the second term have given weapons that killed Russian military and civilian personnel in the Donbass and elsewhere, in Kursk, in Crimea. So I just want people to understand that thousands of civilians died under the Trump administration. And of course, Russia lost a number of very good and courageous soldiers and civilians in Syria. But I just want to say that Russia is a country that is a stable diplomatic power, and you have to recognize that. And if Jelani can go to Washington and to Brussels, as one Russian analyst put it, of course he must come to Moscow too. He can't just go there and can't come to us, right? So since he's good enough for the Europeans and the West, he also must go to the other centers of power so there can be a balancing of political forces, right? And since Russia has the special relationship with Syria and military presence there, it was necessary. Of course, Putin wasn't overwhelmingly, and think about that language, the Syrian people, not his government, not him personally, the Syrian people. Russia still has a position for the Syrian people. There are still people on the Russian military bases, right? Alawites, Christians, others who are still getting protection from the Russian military. So I just want people to understand that it's a little bit more complex. Of course, I don't like it personally on a personal level, but I understand where it comes from. And if you're getting upset about this, this is exactly the propaganda that they use against us about Molotov-Ribbentrop. Yes, Molotov shook hands with Ribbentrop. Yes, there was an agreement. But behind that agreement was strategic thinking about what was to come. And I think Russians also have in their mind strategic thinking of what is to come, even the day after Jelani. Let's be frank.
Can you guys in the chat, like, stop crashing out? You're going to piss me off. Like, this, Russia is partners with Israel. Last I checked, Russia has three bases in Syria. Like, what are we talking? It's three, right? Or is it four? They have three installations at
minimum. They have multiple. They have two major bases.
Any military in Israel? No. Who did Israel send patriots to a couple weeks ago? Did they send patriots to Russia? No, they sent patriots to Ukraine. So what are you guys talking about? Then they do this whole, oh, there's Russians in Israel. We went through this in detail on one of our episodes. Putin has said it multiple times. He does not call them Russians. He calls them Russian speakers. They are from Pale of Settlement and areas in the USSR. They are not necessarily ethnic Russians. Stop the madness. Like, guys, stop. If you guys keep saying, like, Russia and Israel are partners. Partners in what?
No, listen. I mean, Russia as a responsible power has, also China does. Okay, the only country that you would support is DPRK. They don't have relations.
Yeah.
With the Zionist entity. Neither does Cuba recognize them. And some other very, you know, small amount of countries. But Russia sees itself as a responsible player. Also, don't forget, Hamas went to Moscow. Right? Hamas went to... I don't see Hamas going to Washington.
What did Putin say about the plan? He said, I support the plan, but most importantly, does Hamas support it?
Right. And also the need of a Palestinian state. He said it. Medvedev said it. Everybody, Lavrov has said it. Everybody said it. Zakharova. Everybody says that Russia cannot cut ties off Israel. Don't forget, there's a lot more in this relationship. There's the Russian Orthodox Church there. There's the Orthodox Patriarchate in Jerusalem. There are pilgrimages that go there. Russia sees a strategic interest. The Church of St. Mary Magdalene is a Russian Orthodox Church right there, right in the shadow of the Dome of the Rock and the Wailing Wall, right? I mean, there's a lot at play. They're going to try to be a diplomatic as possible. With these relations. But don't think that Netanyahu necessarily is fond of Putin or Putin's fond of Netanyahu. It's a lot of that diplomatic theater as well. But don't forget the Israelis and the most rabid nationalists and fanatics in Israel support Ukraine, right? And want to give more arms. Zelensky even said he wants to turn Ukraine into an Israel, right? Remember?
I wrote an entire article about it.
Right.
About their ties and how close exactly. They actually really are. They're incredibly close. So until you guys can produce an article of that magnitude that I wrote about the relations between Israel and Ukraine, and you can produce one about the relationships between Russia and Israel, I will stay the way that I am and call you guys liars and trolls. Okay.
That's it.
Moving on, just really quickly, before we get to Chris's trip, and then I can let you guys go. This No Kings rally this weekend, all over the map. Look at it. Look at how many protests there was for this No Kings rally.
Oh, boy, everywhere. Look at the concentration of the rallies, too. It's very interesting. It can give you a whole... Look at
that. So I said, what are these No Kings rallies? What the hell is going on?
Central part of the upper part, like the Michigan area, Minnesota, Wisconsin, then also the West Coast.
Whenever I see such a well-organized and large protest, I go, my spidey senses start tingling, and I want to know who's supporting it. So, of course, I was like, who are the partners?
Yep.
You can just scroll and you see like Soros fist. There's rainbow flags, another feminist majority, progressives. There's DSA. Like, it's just the usual suspects. Another Soros fist. There's the other one. Like, it's just stop AAPI hate. Like, it's all this lib shit nonsense. Yep, usual suspects, Soros money. And I'm like, what is going on at this place? So I'm like, then I go to the website. I'm like, why is it so blue and yellow?
Oh,
very blue and yellow. And I was like, that's very subliminal. Well, then they tell you why we wear yellow, because they support the Hong Kong protests and the Maidan.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Why are we supporting these people?
Yep.
Then I'll put the icing on this shit cake. George Conway shows up wearing a shirt that says, I am Antifa.
Oh, my God.
What dimension? First of all, what is going on with his hair? Is that like spray on hair?
That's horrific. What a toupee.
And the bandana.
Maybe he went to Turkey and got a hair transplant.
George Conway, husband of Kellyanne Conway, who invented the term fake news and was Trump's last Caroline Leavitt from his last administration, is now Antifa. That's where we're at. Washington, D.C. beltway millionaires are Antifa.
Wow.
Speaking of Antifa, your trip to Africa, how was it? And tell us what you did. And let's go from there. I have tons of clips.
Listen, I mean, Burkina Faso, you know, it was an opportunity we couldn't pass up. I really wanted to go. We got invited. It was the 30th anniversary of Thomas Sankara's assassination, and we said, let's go. So I was there with Jackson, and it was fantastic. Listen, Burkina Faso, you can tell, Thomas Sankara made enormous strides for the country. Then the junta that came into power, of course, sold off the whole country, sold off everything to the West, especially to France and the US. It was a joint operation. And now with the leadership of Captain Ibrahim Traore, it's unbelievable the changes that are going on. You saw the flags of Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and you saw the Russian flag.
And they always do that.
Yeah, no, let's take a look.
We're here at the 38th anniversary commemoration of the assassination of Thomas Sankara here outside of the Thomas Sankara Memorial. Just now we had heads of states, ambassadorial delegations, diplomats, and all leaders throughout the country, from local, regional governors and military leaders who come to pay their respects, lay the wreath, and of course, to have a military ceremony and a parade. We saw, of course, drill and ceremony. We saw all of the beauty of the Burkina Faso military forces that are now fighting for their survival and fighting against terrorist groups backed by the West. Just as Thomas Sankara was executed and assassinated 38 years ago this day by the CIA, the French, and other Western intelligence forces, what we are seeing here today is another attempt to destroy Burkina Faso's revolutionary government and to once again enslave the people of Burkina Faso and the region. But they stand tall and proud, and they continue to fight for their self-determination, their sovereignty, and their independence, along with Mali and Niger.
Was such a good. I have a very large soft spot for Thomas Sankara. He is my favorite of the African freedom fighters. So I really loved that video.
No, it was great. Listen, it was amazing to be there and to be on the spot where he took his final stand. I didn't really know as much detail as I learned there about those final moments and the 12 comrades who were killed with him. And it was amazing to see I love this symbolism as somebody who studied theology and religious studies, like Thomas Sankara and 12 of his comrades killed. I was like Jesus and the 12 disciples. You know? No, really. I mean, and this kind of symbolism is used and the memorial. They built a new memorial to it. It was really amazing. The hagiography that now exists for Thomas Sankara. They're going to build an 87-story tower to honor 1987. And basically you got to go down and you're going to go down and see the spot where he was assassinated, but you have to first go up 87 stories and then come down. That's the concept that they have. Really beautiful, really amazing. The country is enormously wealthy, but that wealth has been plundered. And just as the great Pan-Africanists like Patrice Lumumba,
Nkrumah, of course,
so many who fought for their dignity, their sovereignty, their self-determination. Sankara, of course, is one of the pillars. And now Ibrahim Traore has taken up the mantle. And they're both young. They both were in their 30s, captains. And it's really astounding what's happening there. I was very impressed by it. I was impressed also at the support, the popular support, the popular mobilization. His pictures everywhere, and people were very fond of him. They say, you know, because you got to imagine, you are impoverished and you're trying to have a dignified life. And they said, even if we are struggling and we are still fighting for our, you know, better economic conditions, we have the dignity of knowing that a black man is in command, not a white man who comes from Paris with those soft shoes and is, you know, plundering all the gold. The gold is in black hands, right? You know, the wealth is in black hands. And that was the whole argument, was that we don't need handouts. Give us tractors, give us heavy equipment, we'll build it all ourselves. And they're building roads, they're building projects, infrastructure all over the place. It was quite amazing to see. And I was very impressed. I can't wait to go back. I had an opportunity to meet with the foreign minister, and he told us a lot about what's going on. But listen, there's a lot of effort to destabilize them, as I said in the video, with jihadist proxies, a big effort. So we got to know that once again, the Islam boogeyman.
So funny, because when France was in there, the United States was giving arms to fight the Tuaregs. Now that France is gone, they're arming the Tuaregs and giving them Starlink. It's just, it's crazy how that happens, isn't it?
Yep. No, of course. And you're right. Somebody in the chat mentioned they've reached agreements with Russia to build nuclear power plants. Yes. They've reached agreements on mining and infrastructure development with China and Russia and other countries in the global south. I mean, overall, there's a lot of good prospects. The question remains, can Burkina Faso and neighboring Mali Niger unify more in terms of their military, political, and economic structures to try to defeat the jihadist forces and the proxy forces, to try to overcome the hostilities and regime change operations that are ongoing, and then to strengthen their position on the continent to be a bulwark for African dignity and sovereignty. We'll see, but I think that there's real support from below in all three countries for this.
But then you came home and you got to go to the star-studded event of the RT anniversary. How was that? Putin was there.
Yeah, Putin came and gave a great speech at the beautiful Bolshoi. It was amazing to see Margarita Simonyan, who, of course, is both having to deal with the breast cancer and also with the passing of her husband, who was very much beloved by everyone. And it was amazing. It was amazing to be there with such great personalities, dignitaries, a star-studded cast. And it was wonderful to be there as someone who is continuing to fight for the truth, continuing to fight for the multipolar world, continuing to try to, open people's minds and to have people be critical thinkers, especially with all of this propaganda, Hasbara, everything that we are inculcated with in the West. And it was an amazing night, really amazing, amazing to be there.
I'm jealous, infinitely jealous, but let's check out our... Our suit, we had everybody out. The whole gang was there.
Everybody.
This isn't a super chat, but I decided to, for your ego, I would give you this. Chris is really hot, and the way he speaks is really cute. I'll have to show Scott the chais yelling that Scott was hot. Thank you so much, Hummus, as always.
Thank you so much.
And Will, I love you too. And I starred this because I wanted to talk about it. Hinkle and Halali in Burkina Faso. Love the ACP. You guys have your own emojis over on Kick, supporting the revolution. Haas giving speeches in China. Meanwhile, the haters are at Hillary Clinton-endorsed billionaire e-funded pep rallies.
It's just true. I mean, I don't know what to say. It's just the facts. And we will continue doing the work that we believe is important. And, you know, forget about this political theater that's going on in the U.S. and all of these, once again, these dead ends for the left. The left's got to build real power, and it's got to build real links with revolutionaries abroad where we can learn from them. And we can learn a lot.
A lot. And I agree. And I think, you know, the trip we took to Iraq was fantastic because it was so much of a grounding experience that I went back and I was like, none of this shit on these American platforms even matters. Like, the real stuff is happening, like, out in the world. Like, there's actual stuff happening, guys.
A lot of stuff happening. We're in the center of it, and DD Geopolitics is going to continue to bring it to you live and in a format that's easily digestible, I hope.
I think we're easily digestible. Take an Alka-Seltzer if not.
It's true. Tums works too, you know. Come on.
Thank you, guys. Don't forget to do your homework, all of your reading. Hopefully we'll have Chris again on Wednesday if the drones stay out of Moscow.
Absolutely.
I'll let you get to bed. Chris, tell Jackson we said hello, and we will see all of you guys on Wednesday, possibly with another special guest. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. What's left?
Take care, everyone.